The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Things start out very complex and sophisticated, and we have a refined language. And then the next thing you know, it is down to name calling, and I'm going to scratch your eyes out. And that's not just in my living room. That's on the global scene. So why the probability of Korean conflict rising every day? Maybe it's because we're all too human. Maybe it's because we're all too childish.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, before we begin today, I think we should mention that you and your dad are ramping up for the next set of conferences. I think it would be worth just taking a moment here and letting people know when each conference is coming. And of course, you and your dad also are offering for free private consultations for people who would like to, schedule time personally with you the day after the conference.
You know, part of the reason Dad's coming back from Asia after 10 years of being over there most of the time, this is our 45th anniversary as a company, 45 years of doing what we do. And so we've met with clients on the West Coast. Now it's time to move towards the Midwest and the East Coast. We start in Overland Park, Kansas, November 3rd, and then go to the Twin Cities in Minnesota, November 7th, Philadelphia, November 10th, Charlotte, North Carolina on November 14th, and then just before Thanksgiving, Austin, Texas, November 17th. Naples, Florida, after the holiday, will be November 28th, and then the last will be Orlando, December 1st.
Well, and I should mention the consultations, the private consultations with either you or your father, Don McIlvaney, they filled up quick, and so we're encouraging people to sign up on the website. The website that you can go to sign up yourself is McIlvaneyICA.com/briefing. And you can click a little box that says that you'd like a consultation. But to make it a little more precise, our listeners can call the office at 800-525-9556.
I would do that in particular. I know the last series of conferences we filled up long before we got to the dates. So we are currently filling up. So if you want to do a consultation with either myself or with Don, please take advantage of that. His wisdom and sort of the distilled insight that he has, 50 years of doing anything teaches you a lot.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I wouldn't miss that.
It's a treat. Going to those last conferences that you did on the West Coast, it was a treat for me. And, I've known you guys for 30 years. You know, Dave, I want to transition here just a little bit because this year has been a significant year. Speaking of 30 years of experience, I've never seen such a dramatic decrease in American buying of coins, bars, physical gold from last year to this year. I've never seen anything quite like this before. Now, it's not happening worldwide. Worldwide, you still have very brisk gold and silver buying. But what in the heck's happening here in America?
Yeah, never a bargain hunter. Averse to value and nearly always chasing momentum rather than searching for an asset selling at expensive levels. This is what I would describe most investors falling prey to. It's why they're their worst enemy, always chasing momentum. And to this point, we have Silver Eagle sales, which in the third quarter of this year, 81% lower than a year ago.
That's astounding.
Gold Eagle sales improved from their abysmal second quarter, still down 80% from the same quarter last year.
Wow.
So roll the clock back. Go to 2011, if you can recall, prices were nearing all-time highs, and the retail volume in the metal space, physical metal space here in the United States, was nearly 800% higher.
Right.
And while global demand for gold still remains robust today, you don't see that same kind of behavior in the United States in particular.
Well, Russia, look at Russia. They just picked up another 500,000 ounces. That's amazing.
That's last month. So they're going to be on target at these paces for the record numbers they hit in 2015, for the record numbers they repeated in 2016. And here we are again in 2017. Looks like the Ruskies are doing it again, adding as many good delivery bars as they can to their cash.
Yes, but did you buy your Bitcoin? That's really the question right now. When you talk to somebody, they're like, what do you think about Bitcoin?
Well, I think all Russian oligarchs own Bitcoin. That's clear. they need to. That's the basis of future wealth. The U.S. market, we conclude when we look at, kind of who's buying and who's not, they're more fascinated with chasing the stock market. You're right. They're more fascinated with Bitcoin or Ethereum reaching fresh highs. buy high and sell higher. That is the momentum crowd's cry. Mm. And, you know, we've mentioned it before in the commentary as the greater fool theory. Again, buy high, sell higher. And it's just too hard. It's too hard to avoid groupthink. Or perhaps it's just too comforting to know that you're not alone and the mass mind provides sort of a validation to your thinking or whatever action you happen to be taking, but you're not alone.
Well, wouldn't you think that the metals actually would be falling in value? I mean, if you've got an 80% decline in physical buying here in America, you would think that the price would fall, but that's not been the case.
That is ordinarily the case. Ordinarily, the decline in coin demand is accompanied by a slide in price, but not this time. Mm. Gold maintains a price 10% improved from January 1. Silver, about half as much of that. Price action has been constructive. In other words, it's been positive. And, you know, frankly, it boils down to this. U.S. investors prefer the momentum game to value. And that's not just today. That's any day.
You know, you mentioned the word comfort. And there's an awful lot of things that we will do for comfort. It's amazing what we'll sell for security. There is a security in doing what your neighbor's doing and what that neighbor's doing and then the other neighbor. But there's a little bit of pain if you're a value investor. I know one of your favorite authors back from the Depression is a man named Benjamin Graham. And he talked about enduring short-term pain so that you could buy value, but that doesn't give you the comfort of doing what the crowd's doing.
Right. The challenge with value and the reason why so few modern investors even know the name Benjamin Graham, who, as you mentioned, is the father of value investing, wrote Securities Analysis back in 1934 and created, obviously was writing that book throughout the 20s. Mm. You have to search for value. That's one of the reasons why it's unpopular. The search itself is arduous. And you must see what others have neglected to see. In other words, you have to have an insight that goes beyond just sort of a surface look at things. And you must take action without the affirmation or without the approbation of your peers. Mm. When you don't get support from everyone saying, oh yeah, I did that yesterday. Oh, I'm planning on doing it tomorrow. All the while, you have to prepare to wait and to wait and to wait for the crowd to come to you. Because you see, it's not that value investors are averse to crowd following. In point of fact, their success depends on it. Mm. But the crowd comes to them. It's a game of chase all the same, regardless of being in the momentum trade or value trade. But wisdom for the value player or investor places the value investor at the front of the pack, not at the back. Mm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it reminds me of something, Dave. I've studied navigation in various cultures, Viking cultures, or, you know, our own European culture with celestial navigation. One of the most fascinating navigating methods is actually in the islands of the Pacific. And you had these men with canoes with just a little sail, and they would have to sometimes go hundreds of miles and find a tiny island. But, you know, their method of sailing was a little different than the way we think. When we think, we go to a destination, we think of the destination, we set sail, we look to see if we see it in the horizon. They do it a little different. They get on their boat, they basically look at the wind, they look at the stars, and in their own imagination, they let the island that they're looking for come to them. And for some reason, that works. In this Polynesian navigation, the island, over time, appears over the horizon and comes to them. It's just, it's a different mindset, but what it does is it allows them to manage what they can manage right there and not something that's outside of their purview.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that a value investor is not trying to control and doesn't assume that he can manage or control, which is the time element. Time is a factor for the value investor, but it's one that he can't control, and I don't think they really care to. So it's patience or lack of it. It's the artificial clock of personal expectation, which determines most choices for the modern investor. Why? Because they're racing towards that financial endpoint. As you said, they're determined to get there and get there as fast as they can, whether it's college savings or retirement or some other goal, unable to see, and this is what they're blinded to in their earnest desire to arrive either on time or ahead of schedule, they're unable to see that the market is totally indifferent to their schedule. And oftentimes the market is cruelly indifferent.
You know, another author that we've interviewed on this commentary, Dave, is Jim Rogers. We've interviewed him a couple of times. And I know he's another author that you really enjoyed. You read his book, Investment Biker, a couple of decades ago. This is a man who doesn't ask anybody's advice as to what to buy. What he does is instead he goes on the road. I didn't read the book, but didn't he ride a motorcycle around the world and just observe and then made value investment decisions from that point?
Yeah, he's taken two trips around the world. Once was in more of a posh four-wheel drive vehicle. Uh-huh. But his first trip was, you know, on an old BMW.
Like yours. No, well, yours isn't old.
His was even older.
But it was a motorcycle, a BMW, and he observed from the ground up.
Right. Rogers in recent weeks describes the end of a market cycle and speaks very firmly about his expectation of a significant decline in stocks. Mm. And he describes it not as some theoretical thing on the horizon, but as an imminent decline.
So soon.
Yeah. I mean, no, the reality is Rogers is always early. And with almost anyone I know, including myself, to be aware of macro-related issues is to be aware of the things that ultimately determine the course of the markets. However, you can be early. And he has been notoriously, as we have, to some degree, been early as well. So I look at him, he's a veteran investor. He retired in his 30s from a lucrative stretch with George Soros and the quantum funds. And what is he recommending now? Well, one of the many things he's recommending. Of course, he likes agriculture. He started not a fund, but an index for that. And there'll be some remuneration as and when there's a massive bull market in ag products. So he's well positioned for that. But he's also recommending purchase of gold coins, which is interesting because he's a trader by nature. He's someone who would probably be more apt to buy in the futures world, buying futures contracts because of the leverage they provide. And that's consistent with his nature.
But he's recommending physical delivery.
He's recommending physical delivery. You know, that's never been his tune. Mm-hmm. But one thing that has been his tune is value. Value has always been his tune. So back to what we were talking about earlier with Benjamin Graham and securities analysis and value investing. Gold is curiously juxtaposed between the East and the West.
Right.
And I think he's got an interesting perspective on that. Rogers is always interested in what people hate. Hmm. As an entry point into an opportunity.
I'll go ahead and take some of that. Remember what Roy said. Roy said the same thing. He says, you want to buy it when they're not buying.
Well, that's right. So find what's hated. And I remember thinking 3 years ago, a wonderful place to be right now would be in Russian equities. Mm-hmm. tough to sell to clients, actually.
You think different than I do, but go ahead.
But the reality is the last 3 years, it's been highly lucrative. And where do you go? You go where the asset is hated and has been left for dead. And it's an entry point. It's not necessarily when you buy, but that's where the research begins. What's there? And I think that's one of the reasons why he may be landing on gold today.
Do you think Singapore, just his living in Singapore, has had that influence on him where he thinks a little bit different, but he still can see as an American?
Exactly, because Rogers, just like the gold market, is curiously juxtaposed between the East and the West. And I think it is to his advantage that he's now living in Singapore and he has the perspective of his previous life as a Wall Street trader. And that is set next to the quieter existence today that he has in a sleepier town, Malaysian city. Singapore's not exactly Manhattan, although it is a real global hub for trade, and it's a wonderful perch from which to note shifts and turns in the region. So for someone who appreciates Asia, moved there, I don't know, 2007 or 2008, wanted to raise his daughter there so that she knew Chinese and could see the future trends of the world through that lens. Gold is out of favor in the West. There's no doubt about that. And the mint numbers are the strongest evidence of that. But it's in favor in the East.
And that's why the price isn't dropping, Dave. Your dad asked me back in 1999, you know, people would send him stacks and stacks of books. And then he's like you, you know, doing research. It's a hard thing. You have to winnow into things and say, okay, what can I spend time doing? And he handed me a book in 1999 called Irrational Exuberance. Okay, now this tech market was hitting all-time highs. Nobody saw any kind of downturn whatsoever. But this book was quoting something that Alan Greenspan had said about 3 years before that, saying that the markets were running on irrational irrational exuberance. I read the book, and the book was very, very timely because it said, you know what? In the next year or two, you're going to see a crash in the tech stock market like you've never seen before because it's running on irrational exuberance. Is that where we're at right now?
The reality is all markets swing from irrational exuberance to irrational negativity. Gold, too, had a moment of irrational exuberance, 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, you look back and read the Barron's article in that time frame. It was the first article praising gold as an asset class that everyone should own. It's the first article of praise that they wrote about gold in 25 years.
When it was hitting about $1,900.
That's right. So you go from irrational negativity to irrational exuberance. Mm. And if you can play that cycle, understand that when you get to the point of irrational negativity, that the risks are fairly well revealed at those cycle lows, and your risks as an investor are fairly well mitigated mm-hmm. to a large degree. So again, going back to sort of the approach that Rogers has taken, finding what is hated, that's the entry point into research. Why this? What's the reason? Can I find any fatal flaws? And if you cannot find any fatal flaws, then perhaps you begin to allocate. Yeah, you mentioned he's a motorcycle enthusiast. I am too. I read his book, The Investment Biker, with glee many years ago.
Right.
And not only from the aspect of traveling the world and what a great adventure story it was, but as a young man, I also had a budding interest in economics. So this goes back 25 years ago. And his book, to me, echoed the novels of Mark Halperin.
Right.
That you had these evocative storytelling sessions of him going through Central Africa and Eastern Europe and Russia.
Right. So there was an element of the exotic, and that's got to appeal.
But as you mentioned, it's a boots-on-the-ground approach to economics, mm-hmm. which is what you have in at least one of Mark Halperin's novels, where this Wall Street analyst is the last of his kind. Everyone has moved to quantitative analysis, but the firm still keeps him around. He's the last of his kind, mm-hmm. and he's paid to travel. And what he does is he sits in coffee shops and he talks to taxi drivers and he makes street level observations. He wants to know the true exchange rate on the street, not at the bank. He wants to know where things are beginning to reveal themselves in terms of fiscal pressure. And that's what he comes back and reports on, is not the quantitative aspects, but the qualitative aspects of an economic environment. And that is precisely what Rogers has as he travels the world. Those are the stories that he tells, the imagery that he creates. Again, those evocative pieces where you feel that you're actually riding along with him down a dusty road.
You know, it's a little different than the fancy equations that we see right now that are applied to what we are told is economics by the central bankers.
Well, and fundamental factors are really what that kind of an analyst is looking for, mm-hmm. right? Value for many people is discovered most often in a bear market because fundamentals are fully revealed in a bear market. Contrast that with today. Because again, fundamental factors in stocks and to a larger degree in the larger economy, they have not played first fiddle. They've played second fiddle to central bank interest rate composition, to balance sheet construction, and all of the unique twists and turns of the tools that the Fed and their compatriot central banks around the world have been using. Rogers echoes our concern that we've moved a long way from being able to adequately value risk in the marketplace. And he echoes our concerns that stocks are not being invested in on that basis. Fundamentals are no longer important because of the index craze, because people are buying an index fund and gaining a broad exposure. They're no longer buying an individual company. They're buying a sector. They're buying whatever it may be. And the trend has been to purchase blindly with no differentiation, with no value appraisal. And in his opinion and ours, it's not likely to end well. So it is back to those fundamental factors.
So, you know, I was talking to a buddy of mine this weekend who we both had the same instructor when we learned to fly sailplanes, gliders. And we were talking about those times when we were just about to stall the plane and Laverne St. Clair was our instructor and he was sitting behind us because the glider was a tandem seating, you know, and so he was sitting behind us, but you could feel the stick. He would say, my plane. because if I was getting into trouble, or if this other guy that I was talking to was getting into trouble, as we were learning, he would take the plane over and he would say, "My plane." Well, until he handed that stick back, we didn't touch the stick. When he said "my plane," what that meant was hands in the air, you're done, until he writes the problem. And then he would hand the plane back and I would say "my plane," you know, when it was time to take back over. In a way, in 2011, 2012, something happened with the Federal Reserve, where we had a free market up to that point, and the market was flying along just fine. Maybe it was close to a stall. Somebody, for the first time in world history, gave all the central markets all the control, and they said, "My plane." Now, at this point, they're saying, you know what, we're about to hand the stick back. Now, is that realistic, Dave? I mean, are they really going to take the risk after having full control of handing it back to the free markets?
That's a great way to frame it. We hear that the Fed will reduce its balance sheet, and they've said that they will raise rates, in essence, allowing the market to be the market once again. And that's after 5 years of utter control, complete control, nearly 10 years of strong influence. And that distinction, I think, is a key one because, you know, they were actively engaged in saving the world from destruction in 2008 and 2009, granted using the same measures that got us into the problem in the first place, but be that as it may, they did bring calm back to the marketplace and prevented utter catastrophe. So they had a number of years where they were intervening, but I think it was the summer of 2011 when Mario Draghi said, "I will do whatever it takes," that it caused a recalibration in the market to say, "Wait a minute, did you say whatever it takes?"
Whatever, and he has.
"You've got my back, whatever happens from this point forward."
My plane.
And so you ask a question, I can only respond with a question. Can you imagine the rock star status which central bankers have achieved? Can you imagine that being retired? And would they be willing to play second fiddle and trust the markets, the natural supply and dynamics, to once again set prices? I mean, again, after determining with really authoritarian control what the natural rate of interest is it likely that a community of central bankers is willing to hand back, for what to them is a wildly unpredictable investment crowd, to determine what the natural rate of interest is? Again, you're dealing with a market which amongst these individuals is mistrusted, and authority and control which is absolutely trusted. They believe in themselves more than they believe in the market. And that's where I tend to be on the opposite end of the spectrum. I believe more in the market than I do in the wisdom of any one man, let alone the wisdom of a collective.
But it's addictive, Dave. Have you ever seen a tyrant purposely hand a country back to democracy? That just doesn't happen. Okay. It's addictive. They have had control. How in the world would they give it up at this point?
And a part of it comes down to results. Authoritarianism gets results faster and cleaner than the market processes, which include risk appraisal and, you know, price negotiation. It's just easier by fiat to say, you know, wheat or corn or soybeans will not sell above this price. You cannot charge more than this for a gallon of gas. I mean, price controls get you where you want to go instantly. And in essence, they are doing away with that risk appraisal. They're doing away with that price negotiation. And we see to a large degree price discovery disappeared over the last 5 to 10 years. Our central banks, is that community willing to allow it back, the process of price discovery?
Yes, but see, the central banks are promising something called wishful thinking. And, you know, one of your favorite poems by Rudyard Kipling, Gods of the Copybook Headings, that is a poem about getting rid of wisdom and maxims and the things that you would record in a copybook and replacing it with wishful thinking. And those who did, those who promised the replacement of wishful thinking, they are in ruins at this time. They're covered with sand.
It's a poem that points to the enduring value of common sense and enduring befuddlement by those who put trust in higher sense. And we read the poem a couple months ago, and read it sometime from beginning to end if you don't know it. But the opening lines suggest that these gods of the marketplace, and perhaps, you know, we can translate that in our own time and place, the high priests of growth and prosperity, the demigods of Maiden Lane, the folks that work there near Wall Street for the Fed, they're not new. These priests of growth and prosperity, they're not new, and their presumption of control is actually as old as any human endeavor. Kipling says, "As I pass through my incarnations in every age and race, I make my proper prostrations to the gods of the marketplace. Peering through reverent fingers, I watch them flourish and fall. And the gods of the copybook headings, I notice, outlast them all. So, I mean, we reflect on the permanent and the perpetual march higher in the equity markets. And we know that there's promises of prosperity. I go back to Francis Fukuyama's book, where he basically claimed that we had reached the end of history. We'd reached a period of perpetual peace, that democratic liberalism had reached a point of permanent plateau. Mm. And it was, in fact, like Irving Fisher's proclamation in 1929, that prices had reached a new permanent high plateau. And this was, of course, just before the crash.
Well, and he could have said the end of suffering. But Dave, you know, whether you're a value investor or whether you're the investor today who's reaping the benefits of just going with the crowd, suffering comes. It either comes as a value investor while you wait. Remember, you were talking about waiting. Wait and wait and wait. Wait for that island to come to you. Wait for the crowd to come to you. There's suffering involved in that because you look like an idiot until it happens. But then, is there more suffering? And I guess I know the answer to this. The greater suffering comes from the person who was with the crowd who followed the wrong god.
Well, you know, underneath every social construct, whether it's a political construct or a market construct, is human nature. So when we look at the assumption of the end of history, when we look at the assumption of the end of the markets or free markets, where volatility is normal because there is a constant push and pull in the price discovery process, you're right. Human nature is what is underneath these things, and why I think ultimately, regardless of the assumption of the end of history, it's just flat naive. Regardless of the assumption of the end of free markets and a greater control and a brave new world, it doesn't work that way unless or until you've altered human nature. You're right. The value investor versus the momentum trader, each of them suffers. One suffers now. One suffers later. And I think I'd rather be the value investor. Your suffering is defined to a degree. The other, for the momentum investors, is undefined as yet by the degree of panic and the stampede to come. And so Graham, this man who was very influential in the 1930s, defined the intellectual framework for Warren Buffett. He may not have actually bought gold at these prices or at any level, but he certainly would not have entered the stock market priced as it is today.
Okay, Benjamin Graham was good at finding value when others didn't. Could he find a needle in the haystack in the current market?
I think that's possible. I think with rigorous security analysis, that is possible. But I think one of the things that also comes to mind is that as a value investor, when he decided to take a time out and move to the sidelines, he grew up, he developed his ideas of value investing. He invested in an age when, by default, if you were out of stocks, you were in gold.
That's right, because cash was gold. And everybody owned gold at that time because they owned some cash.
The age prior to the 1930s was the age in which cash and gold were the same. The default mechanism coming out of the equities markets, getting out of stocks, was going into a currency which was 100% gold-backed. How things have changed.
Yeah, now
you have a second decision to make. But at that point, it was just common sense. If you wanted to reduce risk in one category, you moved to cash, which was the same thing as bullion.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, let's just ponder that for a second. You were either in stocks or some other investment, or you were in gold every time you were in cash. Speaking of cash, okay, we've had a guest on. We have him on almost every year. Love him. He's up in Scotland. Russell Napier. Russell's scratching his head right now, and he's saying, you know, speaking of that cash that's not backed by gold, where is it if the central banks are adding $300 billion a month in some form or another of liquidity in quantitative easing? Where is this, what we call M2, monetary growth?
That's right. Each month, Russell writes a small missive for institutions. And there's a lot changing in Europe. Like we had our implementation of Dodd-Frank, approval of a massive set of legislation to help change and improve and maybe even bring safety measures into our marketplace. The same thing is happening in Europe today. And it's interesting. It's the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, the MIFID II, which is their equivalent of Dodd-Frank. And it goes into effect January 1. The challenges, just with Dodd-Frank, it introduces massive amounts of complexity. In an attempt to bring greater transparency to the derivatives market and other markets, they may in fact be bringing a lot of chaos and turmoil into the financial markets.
Maybe creating the next crisis like Buchstaber talks about.
Again, just on the basis of unintended consequences, Buchstaber was involved not in the creation of the MiFID II, but was involved in the creation of Dodd-Frank and the Volcker Rule, in which he says we solved one problem, but we did create the next round of
problems.
He was
part of it, and it scares him. He wrote a book about it.
Right. Well, Napier writes for an institutional audience, and institutions, I mention the new directive because his world is changing and his audience, they're having to adjust to a new world of regulation and immense complexity. Napier is looking right now at the Fed's announcement of normalization, which we've been talking about today, as problematic. And first of all, he takes that opinion because he sees bank credit growth in the United States slowing. And so credit growth is slowing at the same time they want to bring in monetary tightening. He says, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. Second, he sees broad money growth, M2, on a global basis, also slowing, which to him suggests that the global economy, led by the emerging markets, is already slowing. And we saw a significant infusion of liquidity and capital 2008 and 2009 by India and China. And not even they are able to help buoy these global numbers. And again, and keep M2 sort of moving in a positive direction. So in the US, you've got money growth, which is today at the same levels that it was when the Fed was initiating quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2, and quantitative easing 3.
Well, and then Europe took over. I mean, there's this appearance that there's sort of synchronized easing.
Well, and his point is that it's an appearance of synchronized global recovery, and it's an appearance. And so the challenge is now when you have the appearance of a synchronized global recovery running into a tightening monetary environment, it's a recipe for recession, if not disaster. Can we repeat the kinds of disasters that we had a la 1987? Absolutely. Absolutely. And his point is also that something just doesn't add up. You have this massive global expansion in credit, and yet you have a slowdown in broad money measures, again, going back to M2. So the central bank community, which is responsible for the creation of money, is failing on the one thing they're supposed to do best, which is influencing the quantity of money.
Well, and that's the equation, Dave. The equation has to create M2, or else the credit expansion has been a failure.
Now, on the other hand, interestingly, there is credit expansion, but no quantity of money expansion.
Right.
So quantity of money, as measured by M2, not happening. Credit, yes, happening. Asset price and risk asset inflation, yes.
Through the roof.
So they're influencing prices, but they're not influencing the ones that they traditionally influence.
Right.
And they can't figure it out. And I think a part of it is they have this long-term commitment to a theory that failed long ago in practice. In the 1970s, the Phillips curve was discredited utterly, but right. They live in a world of theory, and the theorizers, again, the central bank community is still in love with the Phillips
curve. Well, it's what they wrote their doctoral thesis on, Dave. You have to protect it if you wrote your doctoral thesis on it.
Oh, and it suggests that you have an improvement in employment, okay? We've had that. But it leads to an increase in inflation. It's axiomatic, according to the Phillips curve, that an improvement in employment brings an increase in inflation. And yet, we wait. I've tried to ask Claudio Borio onto the program, and he's a pretty busy guy. He runs the Bank of International Settlements, the central bank to central bankers. I'll continue to ask him to be a guest. But he's one of the few that I know of in the central bank community who looks at the Phillips curve and says, yeah, it works sometimes. And sometimes it doesn't. So just be willing to set aside some of your underlying assumptions and realize that that one might not be workable.
So what they've done is they've left the punch bowl out because they're looking for something that isn't there. Yet the asset price inflation, I mean, the price of stocks and assets in general has just gone through the roof.
Oh, that's just it. You're exactly right. We've mentioned William McChesney Martin, who suggested taking away the punch bowl before the party gets started. They've left the punch bowl out too long because they've been looking for this indication of inflation. And they knew that if, according to the Phillips curve, that you reduce unemployment, that you should then see an increase in inflation. And when they saw an increase in inflation, they'd know when to toggle back. They'd know when to take back the punch bowl. And And they're not doing it because inflation is not responding. Consumer price inflation anyways. Now, asset prices, they're already in the tornado, already spiraling up and out of control. But the central bank community, they're fixated on the CPI. They're fixated on consumer price increases, and they're waiting to see them jump before shifting gears. Mm-hmm. Napier suggests that maybe they've waited too long because now, in fact, you're beginning to see this deterioration in terms of, on a global basis, a deterioration in M2. Which to him suggests a slowing in economic speed everywhere.
Right.
So growth dynamics globally are shifting, a downshifting collapse in global money growth may create financial market chaos as and when the Fed follows through with its recently announced plans to shrink its balance sheet and raise rates.
Okay, well, I want to go across the seas because sometimes you see strength in something that's weak only because the thing that it's being compared to is weaker. And we've seen the dollar rallying a little bit against the euro here recently, and it has to do with these strange goings-on in the Spain-Iberian Peninsula region. I mean, it's incredible what we're seeing over there.
Yeah. There's a number of good things that come from the Iberian Peninsula. One of them is the greatest ham in the world. But, you know, what's in the news this week, we watched a King Has No Clue, not King Has No Clothes, but a King Has No Clue moment where Mariano Rajoy, your top dog, the chief executive in Spain, sends in troops into Catalan, begins jailing regional officials, shuttering hundreds of polling stations, destroying ballot boxes.
In the name of freedom, Dave. And, in the name of freedom.
And even beating up elderly pensioners. Mm. There's about 1,000 people seeking medical treatment from police brutality. And then he had the gall to claim that there was no referendum which had occurred. Now, he was only able to close down about 330 of the polling stations.
Several million had already voted, hadn't they?
2.2 million votes were counted at the 1,700 polling stations that remained open.
But this confused the European leaders. I mean, they're all looking at this going, wait a second, I thought we had the end of history.
What the Franco is going on? That was one of those what the Franco moments. And he really did. Rajoy is creating something that for most European leaders is appalling. The violence, the non-diplomatic approach, bringing back Franco from the dead. This is from a man who was actually supporting the opposition group in Venezuela. Hmm. And you know who was writing in the local paper in Venezuela saying, this guy's totally inconsistent. You know, he suppresses any dissent in his own country, but he supports it in mine. This is the dictator Maduro in Venezuela. He's actually giving political commentary on Rajoy. And again, just does this guy have a clue what's going on?
And for the person who's not following this closely, this is similar to Brexit or the Scottish vote. This is if England was a little bit more, Spanish, they probably would have had this type of thing happening before the Brexit vote, right?
Well, that's right. And we did have, as you mentioned, the Scottish vote, which was the question of, do we want to extricate ourselves from the UK and be our own country? And that's what the Catalonians are saying. I mean, they're basically saying, look, we've got the referendum. We have 90% of the people voting. And this is 2.2 million people voted out of 7 million total in the population, a reasonable turnout. And it opens the door for them leaving Spain altogether.
Well, doesn't it also affect the euro as a whole? I mean, this is just one more chink in the armor of Spain possibly needing to leave the euro, right?
Well, it explains why violence is the answer and why police brutality is the first measure chosen, because Spain cannot afford to have these 7 million people secede. That one state represents 20% of the entire Spanish economy. And so, I mean, what do we conclude? Populism is not dead in Europe. Mm. Populism is not dead in Europe. And, you know, we do see, as you mentioned, dollar rallies, the euro declines. It is one more chink in the armor in terms of the euro project dating back to that meeting in Rome 60 years ago, which set it all in motion. Can it come unglued? That question is still a reasonable question, and it remains unanswered.
Well, unless we be distracted by violence in Europe and forget the potential real threat. I mean, Korea is still brewing and probably brewing pretty hard.
When I listened to the UN speech that Donald Trump gave, and it made me smile, I also had to kind of shake my hand and go, oh, no. Mm. Oh, no. Because you're right. On the other side of the world, we've got Little Rocket Man.
That's his words.
As our president affectionately refers to Kim Jong-un, and he continues to explore delivering all kinds of weapons into the West or onto one of our allies, and he prefers the hydrogen bomb. So, I mean, I cannot imagine imagine living in Japan the last couple of weeks. In recent weeks, you actually could look into the sky and on at least one occasion see the jet stream created by an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, flying overhead, launched from North Korea.
Yeah, but never mind the fear. I mean, you've got the Bank of Japan saving the day. They're buying stocks anytime they fall. So,
well,
so don't worry about it. If you're nervous about that, we'll buy the stocks.
Well, that's right.
We've got your
back. No real evidence of tension in the stock market there. You're right, because the Bank of Japan supports the bid in stocks. Hydrogen bombs, I didn't realize this, but using fusion rather than atom bombs, their cousin, which uses fission, are far more destructive and therefore don't need to be as accurate. So because they cause anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times greater destruction, you just have to lob that thing into the right vicinity. It doesn't have to be pinpointed, and it'll get the job done.
Well, let me ask you, people poo-poo sometimes the idea of an EMP, okay? But when you have a nuclear blast somewhere, it does fry the circuits of a surrounding region. And we live in a connected age, Dave. I remember my panic when I started to think that I lost my phone on my way back from Israel the other day. And it hit me just how much I, too, need connection. Do you think EMP is a real deal, or it's an issue that needs to be thought about?
Oh, it's interesting. Every once in a while, I'll read the Daily Reckoning, and Jim Rickards wrote a piece this week about, you know, the impact of an EMP burst and how if the North Koreans wanted to, there's not much of a time gap between now and when they could pull that off.
Hmm.
And you just have to lob it into the atmosphere, and a large enough EMP burst is adequate to knock out the U.S. power grid completely. Now, you're talking about a massive logistics crisis. We, in our client conferences, had talked about what it would be like to lose just one part of our electric grid and how our electric grid is tied together by the equivalent of a couple of very large fuse boxes.
You met with a man who was a specialist in that, who was hired to identify that problem.
Oh, that's right, and try to mitigate the issue. Now, this is, again, from the 30,000 foot view, or maybe it's the 80,000 foot view, an EMP burst at that kind of an altitude, neutralizing our power grid, you're talking about millions dead in the United States. Millions. I don't remember how far we took our Star Wars program under Reagan, but it makes you think, well, this is when you need it.
Well, you certainly hope they took it far enough. Let's just put it that way.
Well, interestingly, Rickards, with sort of a swipe at cryptocurrency, says this is why I recommend gold, because it's not dependent on the power grid. And he is right. I mean, you have to have connectivity to use your cryptocurrencies. And in that sense, you are 100% system dependent. Gold is a standout, not only as no one's liability, no one's counterparty risk, but also tied to no one's internet infrastructure, which is a fascinating thing to even consider in this day and age.
Isn't it interesting? I mean, I was flying over Iceland the other day. What an unusual way to get home from the country of Jordan. Okay. But I was looking down on Iceland and I was thinking, you know, a huge amount of bitcoins are processed, you know, using the formulas there in Iceland because the power is cheap. China is even more so. I mean, don't they produce about 70% of the bitcoins that are out there at this point?
According to The Economist, 70% of new bitcoins are being mined in China.
Hmm.
And it's interesting because they can't get them to market. There's capital control issues. There's trade issues. There's exchange issues. There's new ICO issues. So you can create them and you can own them. It's not illegal to own them, but you can't trade them. It makes it very interesting. It makes me think perhaps there's a larger shadow supply, and that shadow supply is continuing to grow, an overhang, if you will, within the market, which for anyone concerned about price fluctuations, shadow supply is an issue. But it's the Chinese government, going back to North Korea, it's the Chinese government which made me think something is getting ready to happen in relation to North Korea. Chinese government allowed a paper in recent weeks to be published, and it explores how to deal with a refugee crisis in the event of North Korean government being toppled. And this is the kind of thing where they don't have open conversation about issues like that. They just don't.
Right.
And again, I mean, this is a high stakes poker game, brinksmanship, negotiation. Perhaps this is just one way of playing it, letting the other side know that you are considering all options. But frankly, it would appear that diplomatic channels are shrinking and deterrence even preemptive actions are a growing possibility.
You know, I think sometimes we overcomplicate things and we think that there are experts, quote, in control. We do that with the central banks, and sometimes we forget that just simple fundamentals will kick back in. You know, we do this with politics and diplomacy. We do this with geostrategic types of things. But really, when you go back and look at history, Dave, it still comes down to just sort of like sandbox kind of politics, where in the end, when one person pushes the other pushes back. And then you start to see another pushing match, and then ultimately somebody slaps or hits the other. And it really turns out into an all-out fight, and it really had nothing to do with high-level expert, quote, diplomacy.
We have this conversation routinely in our house, not about Little Rocket Man, but about escalation and de-escalation. Mm. And, you know, when my 11-year-old announced the inevitability of conflict with North Korea at breakfast earlier this week, he gave his time frame, you know, within 2 years. It was like he had some sort of an intelligence contact. The way he just said it with such certainty. Within 2 years, we'll be at war with North Korea.
It sounds like he's the son of his father, who was the son of his father.
Well, I asked him if he had learned anything about the process of de-escalation from his siblings, that he might offer as advice to bring things off the boil on the Korean Peninsula. And I'm looking at his other brothers and sisters saying, you realize how these problems get started, right? You have an argument, and then somebody hits someone, and then someone hits someone back twice, and that's escalation. How do you de-escalate? If you can tell me how you can solve the problem, I'm going to get you on the phone with someone in Washington. Mm-hmm. But his comment relating to sibling strife was that it's just so hard. It's so hard in the moment to not push back, to not hit back, to not verbally jab back when you're in the fight. And I mean, again, things start out very complex and sophisticated, and we have a refined language. And then the next thing you know, it is down to name calling, and I'm going to scratch your eyes out. And that's not just in my living room. That's on the global scene. So why the probability of Korean conflict rising every day? Maybe it's because we're all too human. Maybe it's because we're all too childish.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And if you'd like to sign up for any of the conferences that are coming up in November, go to McIlvaneyICA.com/briefing, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.